It's been a joy to hear Caesar and to learn from him and from our other sisters and brothers from around the world. So we're all yours.
Thank you very much. I thought that it's going to be a tough time when we have soccer, big soccer matches. We don't have meetings in our church. But I can see that there are more sacrificial lambs in this country than I thought. What I really thought I would do, because yesterday I felt absolutely like I felt very bad that I had the last few points that I would have liked to spend a little bit of time on each, so that that will probably provoke a lot of questions. Then what I have done is I've set up a series of questions which I'll put up. I make a statement first of all, and then I set up a question, and then hopefully we can interact. Now, I don't know how we're going to do that, because unless I repeat your question or your comment, or you can come here and make the comment so that Megan can record you up there. Let me just make sure about time. Okay. So hopefully we'll have a lot of interaction, because really that was the idea, that if we could have time to talk to one another. I just thought that I would drill this down a little bit, especially after one of the questions about pie in the sky, drill it down a little bit to say, is there a room for some what I call personal philanthropy? Okay, now, I use this title deliberately, but please understand that I use it within the context of saying your individual responsibility within the context of the collective. Now, I use that word collective quite a lot. This is a very loaded term in our country about the collective, because political leadership is expected to act within the collective all the time. But what I thought is critical for us this afternoon is to say, is there a personal question that I should be asking myself regarding this issue of philanthropy, of giving? And I'm really hopeful that you will notice when we go to the other part, I'm not going to start with the slides, I'm going to start with the summary, Megan. I must remember that there's Megan up there all the time. But just to say, basically, how do we ensure that we've got this joy? Now, and some of these may seem a little bit awkward to raise, to say, this is what can give you joy, and I'm stabbing you with a spear. I say, be joyful. But you will get at least my drift. In my other life, I'm a pastor, and I think it's very important for me to say that I'm a pastor. I've worked a lot in youth work. I started in 1967. Where were you? Maybe you were still a romantic idea in somebody's. But in 67, I started. I became a Christian in April of 67. Within 2 weeks of that, I was actually preaching on the streets of Soweto. And I started doing youth work from that point on. Now, of course, I've been more of a Christian than I've not been a Christian in my life. But up until that point, I came from a decidedly anti-church, anti-Christ, not anti-God, but anti-Christ background, where we declared God as a liability through Christ. So we always used to say, we want the Father, don't send the Son, because the Son might play and route to come and deliver the message, so you come yourself. So this is a little bit of my background. So basically, I'm a pastor, so you will maybe see this creeping in a lot in my talk. But I'm also a very media person. I've run a lot of media programs, so I'm very conscious of the need for people to understand what they're hearing, because we believe that informed people are best placed to broker their own democracy, okay? And democracy, you know, God is not democratic, I mean, let alone being a Democrat, he's not democratic. But we believe that we really should understand each other in terms of what we say, so that we can be able to best broker our own democracy. So I've done a lot of media work, but I'm also in business. And I had to re-engineer my life into business. after 1994, a lot of my friends who were activists, both within the church and outside the church, in the liberation struggle, they had to re-engineer themselves. I stuck to ministry, to youth ministry in particular, for a better part of 9 years, when I realized one day that actually I cannot continue doing youth work, because I was sitting with one of my sons and we were listening to music, which I did not understand. And he heard every word in the song, and I heard none of the words in the song. Then I knew it was time to move on. So I moved on then and started the Youth Development Foundation, which was intended to raise resources to enable ministries to go on without having to travel long distances to try and raise financial support for the organization. That in turn led me into serious economic transformational issues. So people call me a tri-vocational person, in that I'm spiritual transformation orientated in planting churches, almost exclusively in poor communities. And secondly, I do what we call social entrepreneurship, by which we try to develop institutions that can bring about accountability for public policy people without being churchy. Okay. And then, of course, the third one is economic transformation. So that's a little bit of my background, and I could spend the rest of the afternoon telling you the various things and how I relate them back to our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come. Come where on earth? How? Here on earth as it is in heaven. So my struggle and my life is about the kingdom of God being translated in the ordinary lives of people. So that's a very broad sort of way of maybe getting. I'm a father of one wife, and in my country that's important, you know, because my president has got 4 already, and he's got 5 fiancés, so he's, anyway, we will not go into that one. And I've got 4 sons. People said, we have children. I said, no, I've got 4 sons, and that's the truth. So that's a little bit about who I am. I am disabled. I'm living with a disability. I like to say that more than saying I'm disabled. I live with a disability, but because of that, there are certain sensitivities that I have that I did not have before. Okay, so you will see me wide-ranging in that way. I deal with a lot of subjects because of my experience. I am 60 years of age next week Saturday. Okay, so you need to know that. So I've been here and there and everywhere. But let's just look at what are some of the things I tried to raise yesterday. I called it a conclusion, but there's nothing conclusive about it. Oops. Maybe I'm going to try and put this over here so I don't disturb Megan. And I'll really try to be quick so that we can have time to talk. There you are. Okay. The first thing that I wanted to say, that if you're going to really have joy, I was trying to say to you that you need to learn what it is to be a neighbor. Now, people have looked at Jesus' words, which says your neighbor is anyone in need. Okay, so that's a huge burden that's placed upon you. But being neighborly usually means developing the sensitivity to see and to hear. You are not a good neighbor if when the wife or the husband is being battered next door, you don't even move. You don't see it. When the children are starving next door, you don't see it. When people are sick next door, you don't see it. So being a neighbor means developing a sensitivity about where you are and your surroundings and what's happening to people around you, in order that you may respond in a manner that is neighborly. Okay? And because when you do that, I use this word, and again, because of time constraints, we can't spend a lot of time on it, where we talk about the redemptive purposes of God. When you are neighborly, you'll find that you will do those things, small or big, if it's within a community, small or big if it is within the nation, small or big if it's in the context of the world. But you will do those things that are redemptive in their orientation, because that's what God would like you to respond to. So neighborliness is very important. It's a very, very interesting notion. And then capacity to empathize. You have a saying in this country that you should walk in a person's moccasins. But basically, because of the experience that you have, or taking interest in the history and stories of people to heart, you tend to understand the sense of fulfillment and joy they feel when their needs are met. Now, this is a very interesting thing. In other words, you don't. It is not when your desires are met, but it is when you see your neighbor's needs met and you see the joy that they have, that you then actually become a recipient of that. Now, I don't know if you've ever worked with really poor people. You probably have here in Oakland. I'm sure you've got lots of opportunities to do so. But it is amazing how you can actually find such strength by working with poor people, because they have a way of enabling you to be empowered through your encounter with them. Okay? So the capacity to empathize is a very, very important one. If you're going to be really fulfilled in your giving, then you have to learn to empathize. Once you've learned to empathize and you give because you are able to walk in somebody's shoes, that giving becomes much more fulfilling. By the way, let me just also correct it midstream, that when I'm talking about giving, I am not talking primarily about money. Now, thank God that you've got money and you can give it, but remember that a lot of times it's never really about money. It really isn't. So we won't go too far into that. But again, that ability to empathize, you can give. You will know what to give. You'll know when to give it. You'll know how to give it. And sometimes it's just sitting down, like the bishop's wife who sat down with the woman for 2 hours and end up with Odi going away with something that she never thought she deserves. Okay? The third one, which again is a whole seminar on its own, reliance on tried and tested traditions of giving within our cultures and societies. And one of the things I was trying to say at the end of our meeting last time was to simply say that we miss the boat so often. I know I have missed the boat so often, because I've gone in and without looking at the traditions of giving within a particular context, I have sought to bring in gifts. And I've really actually destroy sometimes the rhythm, because some of us are like elephants, and you come into a poor situation and you will crush people with your giving if you're not careful. So it's very important to go into that thing. Now let me just give an example of this. A lot of cultures off of the North American continent and Europe are cyclical in their orientation. Okay? In other words, when you meet me as an African, before anything else, I want to tell you where I come from, what happened to me and to my people. I tend to look backwards. So I move forward in reverse. Okay? But what happens with the Americans? It's a linear orientation. You, as soon as 2009 is over, that's it. You're looking at 2010 and on and on. But very little is referred back. I mean, when you look at agriculture, the things that has devastated the created order often, it's because when I look back, when we went back to our village after 40 years of exile in South Africa, when we went back, the first thing that the elders did, who were youngsters during that time, was to teach us about how to look after the trees. Now, all what we wanted is to make charcoal and to make fire and to make energy, and they taught us how to preserve trees. So we had to go back and see how they actually lived, how they could actually have those forests and still have the fire and have the food and so on and so forth. One of the interesting questions is, how come they did not have as many sexual transmitted diseases before? And what we've done with some of our young people, say, go and interview a person who's over 60 years of age and ask them, how did they used to date? What did they used to do on a date? And you know, Ezekiel tells us, go to the city, stand at the crossroads, inquire of the ancient ones, and choose the right path. It's right there. So it's very interesting that you have to look at the tried and tested traditions of giving within any of the cultures that we encounter. And then the realization that, you know, actually you are expected to give. When you go into a situation, you are expected to give. If we have a saying in our language, visitor, please arrive, so that hunger must go out the door. Now, what that means is that in any family, there's always reserved food that is put aside in case a visitor comes. Now, if you don't come, that food will never be eaten. So please come so we can eat, you see. But by your coming, actually, you release certain things within the community itself. Now, guess what? If you bring additional things to augment, and the key word is to augment, you're augmenting what is already there. All right? You're extending what is already there. It's very important. You are expected to give. But you're not expected to give out of what you don't have, but rather what you do have. The other one that I think is very important for Christians is to appreciate our own blessedness. And this is where it beats me that often when I have gone, one of the latest congregations that we have just seen the Lord bless us with is among retrenched farm workers. Okay? And these farm, the first thing we noticed when we got into this community of tin shacks was the number of chickens and pumpkins that were jumping over to go to the gathering space. And it was very interesting to see how when we got there, these people, because of their sense of being blessed, they could bring the fruit of their labor. They could bring a pumpkin. The last time I was in this congregation, by the way, I took a truck of spinach with me because I grow spinach in my yard. And I, you know, but that's what I had. I didn't give a penny. I didn't even preach. That's all what I brought to the community. Appreciation of my own blessedness. Okay. The seventh point I wanted to raise yesterday also was rejoicing appropriately and celebrating the rewards of giving. Now, you will hear me make a statement a little bit later that you do well while you do good. Because it's a funny thing. When you give, you tend to receive. It's just a simple formula that I've learned. You see, I have a friend of mine who's a Zimbabwean, and he's the one who helped me to go to Wheaton Graduate School. And I'll never forget when I was complaining about a friend of mine who I've helped so much. He said to me, Caesar, do you remember how a cow is encouraged to give milk? Now, I know I should say how a fridge is encouraged to give milk. But where I come from, he said, how a cow gives milk. Well, by actually, you see, I don't know if you know what I mean by that. What is that in English? Yeah, milking the cow. The more you do that, it's amazing how more milk comes. You see, if you want the cow to give you milk, you take the calf and let the calf get a little bit of the milk, and the mother relaxes and starts giving more milk, and you get milk that way. But it is when you give, it's amazing how you're able to receive. You don't give, you cannot receive when your fist is tight anyway. But it's amazing, with the same hand that you drop money in the bucket, you can also take the money out of the bucket. I say, now don't try that in your church, but anyway. But to celebrate appropriately, and I'll come to that in a little while, be thankful and give God the glory, because the sower will always reap. However, you mustn't give for the rewards themselves, or the motive is self-serving and selfish. But there will be reaping by the sower regardless. You will do well while you do good. And I ask the question, what comes first? Should you first of all try to do well before you do good? No. You do good. And you do good because it's a good thing to do. And I can tell you now from my own personal experience that you will do well. Now, are there instances where you don't do well? Of course. But when you don't do well, it doesn't matter. But the principle basically is that when you do good, you will do well. And that the wellness sometimes is monetary, sometimes it is not. But you do look for those pointers that says, I am doing well. And the last one, which is very, very close to my heart, is appropriating the power gain while doing good. Resisting subjugating people to the slavery of gratitude. Every giver, it doesn't matter how much you give, accrues some sort of power, whether we like it or not. You go to any poor community and you give as little as you think, wow, this is so little. But that gives you a certain amount of authority because you've given. And the more you deny that, the more you mess up, actually. So it's very, very important. So we need to appreciate the power. Now, if you are an English literature student, you know that they say power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And then that's why we've got problems with a powerful God, because he's got corrupt. But the point is, we never really learn how to use power. We don't know how to deal with power. All power is given unto me. We don't know how to use it. So, And because we don't do that, we tend to abuse it. Because we actually don't understand. If you give a little child a very sharp knife, I love cooking. I just indulge, Pastor, I must confess. Confession is good for the soul. It's lousy for your reputation, but it's very good for your soul. I just indulged in some brilliant knives. And they are sharp. They are not cheap, but I said, you know, I like to cook. So I bought these knives. And the first that happened with my sister-in-law's son, he almost cut his finger off because it was too sharp. Okay. Now, if he understood how sharp that knife was, he would not have cut himself. So if you don't understand the power that you actually have, you can hurt people. Seriously. Seriously. So we need to use power wisely. Power gained thus should bring about several things. One, the realization of the hopes and aspirations of the beneficiary. So I must always be prepared to use the power that I've got for me to assist the beneficiary to realize their hopes and aspirations. Okay? As well as the engendering of enthusiasm. I like this one. And that is why in that case, I said, does God want me to be happy? Of course he does. God likes me to be happy. The one time where I had serious problems with my family was coming out of Gaza Strip. And I had seen some things there that even the worst times of apartheid were not like that. And I got home, and I honestly could not watch comedies on TV. And my wife was really, really concerned about this. I lost all enthusiasm for mirth and for joy and for, you see. But one of the most amazing things is that when you've given good gifts, it brings about enthusiasm. When people are not enthusiastic after you've given, ask yourself, what was wrong about the way in which I made that gift? Okay? Enthusiasm that is fueled by an envisioned life as a result of your intervention. The quality of your joy will be dependent on the extent to which you gave without any expectation of return, but driven by the biblical notion that to whom much is given, much is required. Now, I thought I would just put those up there for yourselves to look at and to say, okay, we hear you, and then we move on. Now, let me come to what we really are here for today. And to just try once again, the purpose, as I said when I started out, is to try and drill down to a personal level this whole issue of philanthropy. Okay. There's a book, I didn't bring it with me this afternoon, which was a culmination of research in Southern Africa about the poor philanthropist. And they had gone into poor communities, and they actually were looking to discover how these communities have survived over the years. If you go into a place like Zimbabwe, now, I thought I understood what it is to be without, until you go to some of those communities where, when you say they have nothing, and yet not all of them are dead. So how did they survive? How do they make it? When the poorest of the poor have something to eat. Well, where did they get it from? Okay, so they did a study around this. So I thought I would start off with some questions. I told you about this, the foundations, and I won't take time with this because I shared this with you yesterday. Matthew 22, these are some of the verses that you can look at. 1 Corinthians 13, you can look at that. Galatians chapter 5, you can look at that. Where giving is a lifestyle. I give because it's a lifestyle. In South Africa, there's a lot. People who are waiters and waitresses, you know that the amount of money, I know this is a university town, so those of you who wait on tables, try and make ends meet, you know what I'm talking about. That they make so little that when you actually have to give a tip, hopefully they give you good service. It becomes difficult at first for me to give 10% of the bill. So maybe that's why I was eating so little because I But as time went on, I learned that as an almost automatic thing that it is right to give. Well, in South Africa, you still have people putting petrol in your car to give those people because you know that actually, but it becomes almost, you feel bad when you don't have anything to give. That's when you know that you've got a giving lifestyle. Okay? To look to the Lord for your rewards is another thing. Well, I've said that quite a lot. I don't need to say much more. Should be planned. I try now, and my family is really sabotaging a lot of times because I always make sure that I've got coins in my cigarette, ashtray in the car, because I must just always have something that I can give to people. Now, I don't give to everybody. Others, I give a seat in the car. Say, no, come on in. Let us go and work. I'm working in my garden. Now, if you help me out, I'll help you out. I'll give you some of my spinach. Just, ah, no. Say, I don't want spinach. Say, yeah, that's right. You don't want any help. Go away. So, and then, of course, this one is very important. Giving is a response to God's grace. And here is my advice about what is best for you in this matter. Last year, you were the first not only to give, but also to have the desire to do so. Grace. Grace is permission. You're not forced to do it. You're permitted. That's grace. You see, that's grace. For if the willingness is there, the gift is acceptable according to what one has, not according to what one does not have. It's grace. It's grace. See that you also excel in this grace of giving. It's grace. To be gracious, I'm sure you understand that culturally more than to understand the fact that grace is God's riches at Christ's expense. You've got the riches from God, which you don't deserve, but you've got them anyway. Okay? Be a cheerful giver. This one I like. But that's probably not appropriate for in the United States, but it's more appropriate from where I come from. So from Scripture should come obedience, which is what Bishop Zach Naringia was actually emphasizing. And from obedience to joy. And this joy is not beating drums and singing hallelujah all the time, but it's the quiet sense of deep satisfaction and fulfillment that you receive. Okay, now we come to the nub of what we're trying to be. The first thing that I've recognized about philanthropy among the poor and philanthropy for you as an individual is that you are simply just being human. Giving, no matter how small, makes you a human being because it connects you to others. It does. There's no way. If you give somebody some love, it connects you to them. You become a human being. Question, how can you be part of a collective and work together for the good of others? And that's the question I want to pose to you. In this context, you want to be human, so you want to give. How does that connect you to other people? Anybody wants to tell me how it does? If it does. I don't want to be the one who gives you what I think. But how does it connect you? I don't know how much you give in this church, but if you put, I almost said used tea bags in the plate, offering plate, but if you put something in the offering plate, how does that actually connect you? Let me just see if we are on the same page here. How does that get you connected to other human beings? Anybody? Onsi? Yes. Yes.
One of our young people is a pastor there now. And it was just mentioned in the pulpit that he's helping with the humanitarian efforts right there.
Mm-hmm.
And within a little more lot, it makes you read the newspaper.
Right, right. It makes you read. Let me just say what for Megan's. What you're saying is that actually, because if you know somebody who's on the field, like in the Philippines, who's a young pastor there, who's helping the people with floods. Question is, did you give him everything that he required, or just part of what he needed?
I personally gave
what you could.
No, not all I could. But it was a little more than I might have.
Okay. But the point is, whatever you gave was not the sum total of what he needed.
No.
Okay. So in a sense, by doing that, you've enabled somebody else's doing that to add. And in that way, you get connected to somebody who may be in Japan that you've never met. But that makes you, suddenly, you've got a commonality between yourself here in San Francisco and somebody in Japan. But more than that, you begin to read the newspapers with a little bit more of a sensitivity, doesn't it? It does. Okay, that's a very good response. Any other? Yes, Ansi.
We have a homeless meal that we serve in this gym.
A homeless meal?
Yeah. And I've helped kind of lead the cooking.
Yes.
And at the beginning, it was very much this joy in serving those who are in need. But as a leader, it became more about enabling others.
Yes.
To enter in and serve.
Okay.
And the joy you see in others serving.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the second thing is then enablement aspect, that you enable others to do what you as an individual could never do. And I think the very wonderful example that I do not have time to expound on is Mandela's example. I mean, you have, you know, at one time, we black males in South Africa did not like Mandela too much. You know why? Because as much as we would have liked to just go out there and reverse everything that the white people did to us, we couldn't. Because he who had every reason to do so, and by the way, it was not just him. There was Kathrada, there was Sisulu, there were many others. They came out of prison. They could have said, Bulana Namapuno, kill the whites. But they didn't. But if they did, who would actually stand up and say they shouldn't? You see? But because of what he gave, he made it difficult for us to do what is wrong. And I want you to understand that dimension. He not only made it possible for us to do what is right, but he made it difficult for us to be bad. If you know what I mean. Now, if you know the kingdom theology, is that right now the restraint that is upon the earth is because of the work of the Holy Spirit in human communities. If we were left all to our own devices, imagine what we would be. But the Holy Spirit would not have the space. Well, he would actually. But we would not understand the Holy Spirit's space if Christ had never given his life on the cross. Right? So by Christ dying, he's made it possible that he could send a comforter, who's today the restrainer. Because imagine if this world did not even have a semblance of godliness through the presence of the Holy Spirit through the believers. Okay, so we can go on. But the point is, when you give, you become part, and you're being human. You become connected into the collective in a way that you may never be able to see. Because, you know, the scripture that says he's the same yesterday, today, and forever. That I can do something today that somebody will build on tomorrow, whom I may never meet, who, and then 3 years later, somebody else does something on top of what they have done. And my concern is not, is somebody going to finish what I start? But am I going to finish the starting? That becomes important, okay? So be human. Whenever you feel like, why am I doing this? Well, I'm doing this because I'm a human being. For me, it's as simple as that. Okay, we've got a few more questions to go. I like this one. There's a book that was written by Alan Busack. After the Reformed movement declared apartheid as a, what is it? Something against humanity. Who remembers? Yeah, crime against humanity. And you know that now that's become a clear and call because Mugabe is afraid to leave power because crime against humanity. The man in Sudan is afraid to go because of crime against humanity. Taylor, Lord Taylor, is in The Hague right now, going through a trial, crime against humanity. And he wrote a book, Farewell to Innocence. Okay? In life, it is impossible to not have helped. I'm glad that English is not my first language, so I hope this makes sense to you. In life, it is impossible not to have helped. If you were really human, it would be impossible for you to go to your grave feeling that I've never helped in any way, shape, or form. Okay? Why? One, because we know too much. There's nobody who can now say, even after this, we didn't know. We did not know what American foreign policy does to the rest of the world. We didn't know. Of course, you can't. So it's farewell to innocence. Okay? Question. What does neighborliness mean? So you can't say, I didn't know. But what does neighborliness actually mean? Let's start as an individual and then let's look at the church. And one of the most amazing things, by the way, here at First Press, and trust me, I know you may take this for granted and not appreciate the grace that the Lord has given you through the leadership to have the kind of sponsorship of other churches to come in here and do work like they're doing with you. It's amazing. So we should look at this as what does it mean to be neighborly in terms of a church, as a congregation? What about as a city? What about as your university? What does it mean to be neighborly? I've met people today who are in business. What does it mean for their business, for them in their business, to be neighborly? Okay? I've got a feeling I shouldn't open this one for discussion. But let me try. Anyway, from the state, I know you are under discipline not to know what the score is, so I won't tell you. But what do you think, sir? What do you think does it mean to be enable that you are at the, to be a neighborly person as a university? What does that mean?
As the university as a whole?
Yeah, as a whole or in part.
Mm-hmm. To recognize the resources that are available and to use the tools that are present in the university.
Okay, so as a university to be neighborly means actually utilizing your resources to begin to respond to the situations around you. So therefore, if I come to an MBA class, your MBA class is not about something hairy-fairy, but it is about how to solve the city's problems. Through economic activity? No. So you're not being neighborly. Okay. But you get the drift. So as a university, your neighbor is your immediate community, is your city, is your, the economy in the city, are the hospitals in the city. I went past your eye center this morning just to look at your famous places. And I was saying, I wonder how many people are blind here that should not be blind, you see, because now there is this neighborliness that we're going to see because the university is busy. But are you getting the drift? But what about in the world? Yes, ma'am. Did you have your hand up or was I? Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Okay. 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 Great. Okay, so he's talking about as a church just to deal with homelessness. We usually have a lot of space. Now, I don't know in this country, but in a lot of countries, the Catholic Church has got a vast amount of land. So, but let me give you an example. Some of you might have read it in the newspapers. I don't know if you've heard about Bishop Vereen in Johannesburg, the Central Methodist Church in the city center. You see, this is the problem with CNN. You see, they won't tell you these things. They'll tell you about the toilets that are leaking, but they will not tell you about the church thing. But Bishop Vereen actually shut down all the activities of the church. You know why? Because he's got 3,200 Zimbabwean refugees sleeping in every single open space in the entire building in the city center. I mean, it's true. It's happened. And that's not why I asked the decision. But it's happening right now. Where the church said, listen, why should we have our holy moment when there are people who actually... And the whole thing is shut. I mean, there are no services on Sunday morning. The people who come to service on Sunday morning is to bring food to the people who are sleeping in the pews. Now, Central Methodist Church used to be the church to belong to. If you are in Johannesburg and you are Methodist. Okay? But that is the sort of point that my sister here is trying to say. But what does it mean to be neighborly as a nation? Yes, ma'am.
To pay attention to other countries and just even know what's going on with
them. Okay.
And then it does not tell us the story of the world. It tells us
about ourselves. Yes. Pre-digested food, we call it. They digest the news before they give them to you. The sad thing is that even in Africa, you know, there is no trans-Africa voice. Africans hear about Africa from non-Africans. And there is nothing more devastating on our continent than that. Because all the thousands of islands of hope that are there in Africa, nobody knows about them. Okay. So it's a very serious thing. But I think, yes, paying attention as a nation, nationally, what is it that we're actually involved with people around the world? Being neighborly. We can go, yes, ma'am.
What happened to the church?
It's still closed.
What happened to the people? You said what time it was the church to belong to.
Yeah.
What is it now?
They've become a bunch of servers. Yeah. Of course, some have walked away. They said, gee, we will not have anything to do with this. Some who are xenophobic have said, Bishop, really, this is not on. But I can tell you now that a lot of my friends who are members of that church, they go there now to serve the refugees. And that is their form of service, actually. Of course, they have to go somewhere else for their spiritual nourishment, and they do that. Of course, there are many Methodists, you know, like you've got First Presbyterians and only First Presbyterians. You don't have Second and Third and Fourth Presbyterians. Even 10th Presbyterian, I just found out to my absolute disappointment that it was not the 10th Presbyterian Church. It was the Presbyterian Church on 10th Street. I was actually taken aback by that. But yeah, but they could go to other Methodist churches. But the point is, those who had a sense of serving, they actually go downtown. And my office is only a block away from the Methodist Church, the Central Methodist. Yes, Uncle Philip. Okay.
And also recognizing their mutual vulnerability. And I think what Penny is saying in terms of paying attention, oftentimes the way we pay attention to people outside our borders is kind of the threats or opportunities.
Here you go. I like that. Thank you very much, Chief. I think that's actually very good. Being neighborly is becoming sensitive, being able to feel, to empathize, to understand, to hear, and to make people less and less enemies. And understand them. I know you said mutual vulnerability, but I want to stick just to the word mutuality. That when I used the word utongati yesterday, and I asked Ms. Tulu, I don't know if you know Ms. Tulu, by the way. Ms. Tulu, can you just raise your hand back there? Just raise your hand. She knows what I'm talking about, because in Natal there's a town called Tongat. But actually the real name was Utongati. And when the colonialists could not pronounce it, they said Tongat. And it's a town now. You can come there. We produce the best sugar cane in the world. I'm sorry. That's not true, actually. See, that's the arrogance of unneighborliness. But Utongat, what it means is that it's very unusual, even in the situation of the most disparities in wealth, that there is nothing you can learn from somebody who is a beneficiary of your giving. It is impossible. And I found that out. Okay, we can go on and on, but it would be so good if you could begin to consider what actually does it mean for me to be a neighbor. It's a very interesting question. Okay, let's look at empathy. By the way, these quotations I've gotten from some of the research. Okay, so there's a whole, behind this sentence, there's a whole bunch of research data that actually supports the statement, okay? Someone who knows suffering knows how painful the results of poverty are. You want eloquence about what poverty does to people? Go to people who have suffered. They will tell you. See, myself, I suffered many years ago. I've almost forgotten what it was like. And I have to sometimes remind myself, by the way, Caesar, you also are what Zach says, you are rich. You are no longer, you can no longer say you understand. You need to go back. Someone who knows suffering knows how painful the results of poverty are. Now, that might create a problem for you. So the question that I have, how can you learn to empathize when you have never suffered the ravages of poverty? How can you empathize when you've never suffered the ravages of poverty? How can you do it? Bridget, I see you are holding your chin like you are thinking about... Oh, excusez-moi. Someone who knows suffering knows how painful the results of poverty are. Okay. The one thing is proximity, right? Create proximity between yourself and people. Now, this is a very interesting one, because how many of you have ever been in a cancer ward? I mean, and I mean serious cancer ward, not the sanitized ones, you know. How many of you have been in a hospice? How many of you have been a Mother Teresa, where all what you wanted to do was to let people die with dignity in your hands? Proximity. It's amazing how you can find it. And I thank God that the empire has struck back. You know, you used to go out to the world has come to you now. And if you really want to know what the world is out like out there, you can go to most of your city centers and you'll find it. In South Africa, you know, we were so arrogant in South Africa. And I remember when the World Cup was announced, and one of the TV producers said, well, we need to find out how Africa thinks about South Africa having the World Cup. And you know what he did? He took the camera and stood at one corner in the city center of Johannesburg. And in less than an hour, he had interviewed about 15 different countries in one corner. The world had come to South Africa. Before that, Africa was not allowed into South Africa, nor were black South Africans allowed into Africa. Now, it's right there. And some of the problems that we have in South Africa, the reason we are so patient, you see, and it's difficult sometimes when the Nigerian drug lords or the this or the that, and we have to say, no, listen, when we in our time of need, these people stood by us, and now they've come home, the chickens have come home to roost. But proximity is a very important one, just to get to know. And now you don't have to go to Africa to find out about what's going on there. There's a lot of them right on your doorstep. You don't have to go to Cambodia. You don't have to go to Sichuan province. It's right here. So proximity is possible. And this is before the electronic stuff, because I'm not a very great believer in the electronic stuff, but it does help, you see, if it is done properly. But proximity is very important. But there is more. Yes, sir. Yes.
I found I spent 10 days in your country, so I do not know all of it. But in my time in Kenya, where I spent a year, I came to empathize with my friends who was able to spend the night with, who graciously opened up their home and hospitality to me. And I never got that just spending the day with someone.
Yes. Yeah.
It was that kind of hospitality, that kind of thing.
Right.
That I feel like I've come close to emphasizing.
Yeah. But by the way, this is very important, and I always say to people, you know, when you go into a situation like that, you'll be surprised how sometimes you are overprotected. I mean, I've been to situations where people have gone way out of their way to make sure that I don't even see the worst of their situation. It's really sad. I once spent a night in Beit Sahur. Now, some of you may know Beit Sahur. It's in the West Bank. And this was during a very difficult time, by the way. And if there's a nation I pray for, it's Israel. Huh? I pray for Israel. Now, you may say for wrong reasons, but I think I really pray for God's grace. But I also pray for the Palestinians. But this one night, I spent the night with the Palestinian family. Beautiful people. But the way they built their house, either they've got a room in the middle. You know, they've got a shell outside, and in the middle, they've got a room which has got about triple thick walls, and they are not made of gypsum board or some nice cladding, you know, like you've got here. I'm talking about something that probably a very serious bazooka would penetrate, but nothing else. And so they, at night, their entire family goes inside and sleeps in that middle, because at that time there was a curfew. Anything that moved outside at night were in the night vision scopes. So in the morning you go out and find dogs and cats and so on, which have been shot because it moved. Now, how do you tell a dog, don't go? It goes and bang, it gets shot. So actually being there helped. But do you need all of us to go to Beit Sahur? No. You can actually speak with the people right here and get close. But that's one aspect. What about others? What else? Yes, Bridget.
I think something else that proximity provides, and it takes it from being a concept of the poor.
Yes. That is so important. Proximity means it stops being an idea, a concept, or a television blurb on the screen, but becomes real. On a light note, you know, the first time I came to the United States was 1970. And I want to tell you the truth. I suspected that Americans were more than cowboys and eating hamburgers and John Wayne with a gun on the... I suspected that, but it took me to come to the United States, to actually be in an American home in the U.S. So, you know, actually, even these missionaries have got parents, you know, just like me. They've got sisters, they've got brothers, and so on. But before that, missionary problems? Ah, no. Just like me as a part, people say, do you ever feel like beating up your wife? Of course not. You are the pastor, man. You can't. But when somebody's in the house and they say, oh, You see, so it is very important that not all Americans are cowboys and eat hamburgers, okay, or baked beans because they need the gas. I mean, I'm sorry. But proximity is important. But can I just move us a little bit from proximity because there are other things.
Well, fasting.
Fasting.
You know, experiencing
the human hour abundance. Right. Okay. How many of you know a guy by the name of Viv Grigg? Have you ever heard of a guy by the name of Viv Grigg? He used to talk about voluntary poverty, where he used to call American young people between the ages of 18 and 22 to take on voluntary poverty, where you took and renounced all of your worldly possessions, and you lived as a poor person who ordinarily lived, did not have access to television or radio or a bank card or a cell phone. Well, they didn't have cell phones then when he first wrote this book. But it was amazing where he went into this voluntary position where he said, I really would like to learn, is it really true that people can survive with nothing? And, you know, he began to go into Mathari Valley in Kenya. Who was in Kenya? Yeah. He went into Mathari Valley and he actually realized, this is how people actually do it. Okay. So there are ways where you can educate yourself. My biggest concern, honestly, in terms of information coming to America, I mean, I've been gone from home and not once on television or radio, and I sleep with the radio on, trying to find news. I've not heard a single thing about Britain, about Germany, about what's going on in any other part except Afghanistan, only once. And I said, what is this? It really worried me. I was actually having withdrawal symptoms. I had to call home and say, what's happening in the world? But because it's so endemic, you don't even recognize how much you actually don't know. And it is shocking. I mean, it really shook me to realize that they don't know. They actually don't know what happened to Gordon Brown. Maybe they don't even know who Gordon Brown is. And you really ought to know who Gordon Brown is, you know. It's very important for you to know. You ought to know what happened to him last week. Because it's got a very telling thing, which maybe is very controlled in the United States, but it's going to hit you. What's hit Gordon Brown is going to hit you. You ought to know. And it's got nothing to do with Afghanistan. He's only sending 500 troops. And Obama, I understand, is sending 45. But anyway, 1,000, that is. Ma'am.
You need to listen to KQ.
KQ who?
PBS.
Yeah. You know, I actually asked my hostess, please, can you give me, because I have to listen to news. I mean, and that's not good, by the way, but once in a while. But how many of us do that? How many of us deliberately say we're going to look for PBS? We're going to actually get ourselves informed. Anyway, it's neither there nor here. But this is a major, major concern of mine. You know, let me just tell you as an aside. You know how we started our church in Soweto? We used to start it on Sunday morning, and not everybody could afford a newspaper. But we used to say we had the newspaper and the Bible. We would read the newspaper, and the question is, does God speak about this? And so we dealt with issues of homelessness, of education. We had to dig deep about land, about militarization. I remember those are the things we actually had to take time. So there was no time in our church to actually say, okay, it's time, time's up. As long as we didn't find the answer, we kept looking. Now, the more blind you see, you should come and teach us how to look faster with electronics. Now I've got a laptop, I punch a word in and I get the answers from the Bible quicker. But in those days, we didn't have that. So we had to actually go through and say, okay, who knows the scripture that talks about this and what does it say? Fascinating stuff. But we made it our business to know. We made it our business to know. Because if I don't know, now of course you become a junkie of this if you're not careful. But if you don't know, you are likely to make horrendous mistakes in trying to be empathetic. Okay. The imperative. There are times when you feel inadequate. Honestly say, and part of the problem with a conference like this is we can hit you with some needs. And you can say, my God, Caesar, come on. We cannot even begin to scratch the surface. There are times when you really will feel inadequate. For me, physically, there's a lot of times like this where I don't feel adequate physically. I cannot give anymore. Okay? What do? But you know that you have to give. Question. What compels you whereby you say, I must do this? While I'm waiting for you to respond, you know, one of the things I've always taught in our youth group in South Africa is that if you give young people something to die for, they will always have something to live for. A young person got nothing to die for, he never says or she never says no to himself or herself. But if you give young people, says, I would rather die than do this, I would rather die than let this happen. When you give somebody a reason to die for, they've got something to live for. Just imagine Martin Luther, the reformer. Here I stand. Here stand. I cannot do otherwise. God help me. I'd rather die. He brought about the Reformation. He has something to die for. For to me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. I'm crucified with Christ. Nevertheless, I live, yet not I, but Christ lives within me. And the life that I now live, I live by the faithfulness of the Son of God. Give me something to die for. America, what are you prepared to die for?
Oil.
I beg your pardon?
Oil,
apparently. Huh? What are you prepared to... What is it that your young men and young women are prepared to die for? Say, I'd rather die. I'd rather go to jail. I'd rather go to prison. I will not. Because there are times, you see, when you feel inadequate, but you know that you have to give. Question, what compels you? What are the things that moves you? That's a very nice spiritual answer I can give you right now. But let me ask you, what is it that motivates you? What is it that makes you angry? What is it that makes you pick up the fruit mixer? What do you call these things? Your blender and hit your television screen because you are mad. What makes you feel that way? What makes you feel like, gee, you know, I'm a pacifist, but I'm prepared to march on Washington. I mean, whatever you want, march on. I'm prepared to go and lie like Ezekiel, 6 months on my side in front of the White House. What is it, sir? That's right. That's right. Injustice. When that happens, folks, it doesn't matter how little or how much I've got. I've got to move. Is that what it is? And you know what those things are? Those are the things that moves the heart of God. As much as you've done on these, the list of my sisters and brothers, you've done unto me. You're moved by the heart of God. Now, if you don't have that, frankly, folks, what are the things that you're prepared to say? You know what? It's okay. It's all right. I can lose my house. I can actually even lose my wife. Forget about my life because I lose my life before my wife. But either way, that's it. I'm sorry. What is it? When last were you angry, actually? Think about it, just in the last 7 days. When did you ever get angry? What were you angry about? Because, you see, McDonald's said 3 minutes so he'll give you your food free. And they took 5 minutes and they still made me pay. My goodness, what is this country coming to? Sir. Yes. Yeah. I like that, how it has been debated about. You know, because in that process, people are being maligned, people are dehumanized, disempowered. My God. We're talking about them as if they are cattle, do you see? Both rich and poor. Yes, sister, and then you, ma'am.
I want to say that, and then I feel at the same time I'm hypocrite, because I'm angry that every 5 seconds a person dies of hunger. And then I say, what do I do about it?
Yes.
What can I do about it?
Okay.
Last week it was a eulogy in San Francisco.
Yeah.
People
that's a tough one. You see, you like a tough life. I can see that. You don't like easy life, do you? Yeah. I don't know if you understand what she's saying. She says, you know, sometimes we don't do the least that we can do because somebody's dying every 5 seconds because of hunger, and we're prepared to just keep extending the girth, you see. You know, if you do that, my beloved sister, I tell you, it is the roughest life you can have. It becomes impossible. You actually need therapy at that point because you can't think. Now, the only thing that I tell you is the secret I got. When I first went into the plane and they said to me, put the oxygen mask on your mouth, and once you've got enough oxygen, give it to somebody else. And then the Bible says, love your neighbor as yourself. So first of all, try to develop a healthy love for yourself. And I know I'm not saying that you're not. I'm saying with me, I had to start there to say, you know, okay, Caesar, actually I need to be able to be in a position to help people, but don't go overboard. So I needed to have a very healthy self-love. And as soon as I did that, I found that I could be able to. But the other thing that Zach, the bishop, said today, and this is very important, that at the end of the day, you've got to let God be God and you be you. Because if you begin to cross those two things and you begin to think that you're God and that God is you and that God should behave the way you do and you should behave the way that God ought to behave, we've got problems. So I say be careful that you put the two together. But having said that, if you cannot be angry even with yourself, that shame on you. How can you indulge so much? Especially when you could have denied yourself something and enabled somebody else without too much of a sacrifice. So I empathize with you very much because I know what it is. I almost broke down today in the service because I remember the days when I did not want to bury one more person. And I honestly went past the cops on the street. I said, you know, Lord, really, you know, you created this earth. You created these creatures. You take care of some of this thing. I mean, I just couldn't handle it. Huh? And there comes that time. I remember when I spent a month in the mountains of Raza, south of Italy, because I had completely lost my mind. Not in terms of mentally being cuckoo, but I was very close to it. I'd written a letter resigning from all my ministries. I'd written a letter to my wife telling her that I don't want to see her again. I just told my family, I'm out of here. Okay? And God rescued me because somebody sat in my living room for a whole day who came from Switzerland, who had come to see me, and I didn't even know they were there. And at the end of the day, they said, Caesar, when are you going to collapse? And I had the letters in my pocket. But there comes a time like that where you need to be careful, where you need somebody else to come alongside you. And often God is gracious to do so. And he's done that over and over and over again for me. But the point is, did I ever get angry? Yes. I got angry that I had to bury all these people. It was not necessary to bury these people. It was not necessary for anybody to kill these people. Anyway, did you have your hand up?
Oh.
So come again, ma'am.
Robbing the poor, middle class, by the rich.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. We're good at that. That makes me... Okay.
Just watching this little 9-year-old African-American boy ask his president, who's an African-American, why do people hate him?
Jeez.
When the little boy says, when God is Lord, it infuriated me that this little boy is growing up in a country where the president...
See, now, we get to know you by the thing that makes you angry. Because if those things, if there is no righteous anger, but the point here that I'm trying to make, really, it's a very simple one. And that is, just check yourself and see what makes you angry. Have you become so soft that things that are not right just happens and you've just completely are blasé about them? What is it that makes you angry? Okay. I don't know how much time we have. Tim, please. Time's up.
10 minutes.
Oh. I never had a situation like that in my life. Where I had 10 minutes left. It's always your 10 minutes over. The widow's mite. Okay. When you give a little bit, it is better than giving nothing. See, I'm trying to cover all the bases. I don't want anybody to say. Now, please, see, I'm not making a comparison. Because for some people to give $1 million is an abomination unto the Lord because they ought to give 10. I mean, look at Melinda and Bill. To say to their children, listen, or is it Warren Buffett? I'm only going to give you 5% of what I've made in my life. The rest, I'm giving it, as they say in Nigeria, away. You are not going to get anything. I'm giving it away. So for him not to have done that would be an abomination. Okay? When you give a little bit, it is better than giving nothing. And by the way, that little bit will be in terms of what people look at it, because for you, it might be everything. Okay? You know the story of the pig and the chicken. You don't know. No. The chicken and the pig were going down the road, and there was an advertisement from some, in South Africa, we say the wimpy. It's a wimpy thing, where you can get bacon and egg. And the chicken said, "Yeah, you see, I'm really feeding this nation." And the pig said, "Yeah, right. You're feeding it, but you're still on your feet. You think I should do it too?" He says, "Yeah." He says, "And then where would I be tomorrow? Because I'll be a piece of bacon on somebody's plate when you'll still be laying a lot of eggs out there. So don't come and tell me you're better than me. I'm not going to feed these people with bacon, because for me to feed them is the end of the road. But you can still give a lot of eggs." So what I'm trying to say here is that please remember that giving can be very relative. Very relative. Some of us, I remember my father died at 58 years of age. Only the last 8 years of his life did he become a very serious, committed Christian. In those 8 years, my father probably achieved, in terms of what happened to us as a family, in our family, more than what I'll achieve in the 30 years of my life as a father and a Christian, in 8 years. So it is sometimes not about the number. It's about the quality of the gift. So the widow gave, and therefore, do you have to wait to feel you have enough before you give? And of course, the answer there is quite self-explanatory, isn't it? Remember, we've got 10 minutes. Give and it shall be given unto you. I like this one. Giving is like depositing something, because tomorrow that same thing will come back to you. See, Americans, you discovered oil first in the Dallas area and so on, in Texas. But now you know there are other people who got more oil than you do. And those people who've got more oil than you do today, in the next few decades, they will have less oil than we do in Africa. So imagine, you people are gluttonous with your oil. I'm so glad that Priuses are the order of the day in this area. You know what is a Prius? I must not take for granted these things. What is a Prius, by the way, Onsi?
The car.
Yeah, the car. That's right, the car, chief. It's a hybrid. I hope they do bring out the better one. And I do hope that you do spend that $25,000 buying that car rather than buying a good old American gas guzzler that is going. Anyway, that's not for me to say these things. But I think there's a very high level of consciousness in this area about the ecological issues and so on and so forth. Somebody came to me and says, "You know what, Caesar? You may not like Bush too much. Most of the time I don't like him, but I think he's a good guy. But one of the biggest gripe I've ever had with Bush is his refusal to sign the Kyoto Protocol. That is, I don't know how you think about it, but I think that is absolutely, totally, dastardly for him not to have signed the Kyoto Protocol." Okay, but anyway, the point I was trying to make is that right now the Middle East has got more oil than you do, but there's going to come a time when the Middle East does not have as much oil as there is in Uganda. So what goes round, comes round. It's a very cynical way of saying things, but I think I just like sometimes to sober people a little bit, to say, you know, there was a time when in Zimbabwe, my friend said, we will never be like Ghana. And today they're worse than Ghana. They're asking Ghana to give them maize and corn. We in South Africa, in our arrogance, say, we will never be like Zimbabwe. What an arrogant statement to make. But when you begin to recognize there is a mutuality about life, you begin to respect others such that you understand that giving is like depositing something, because tomorrow that same thing will come back to you. It's like the way you bring your children up. It's coming back to you. And so with this, I want to say what comes first. And I really would like to end with this one. What comes first? Doing good. But how many of us actually do that? Just, "Lord, if you can just give me this job, I'll show you some amazing things, but the job, Lord. If I had $1 million, I can tell you, I will not allow any homeless person to be there on my street. But Lord, the $1 million. Which comes first? And I've learned that when you start by doing good, it's amazing how before very long, you begin to do well. Sometimes that wellness is not only financial, but thank God that in a lot of instances it is. But that doing well sometimes is your own well-being. Your outlook on life. In our country now, we've got a thing called the Black Diamonds. It's a black people now who are the nouveau riche, the new millionaires, who are the sum total of what they have. And I tell you, those are the worst people in terms of giving of themselves, of their time, or of their talent. But those people who are not looking to do well first are the ones who will volunteer, who when there is a marathon, they'll be out there giving water to the runners, who if there is a football match, they control themselves until after the beat. I'm joking. All in all, folks, I'd like to say I've never had a happier life or moments in my life than when I gave, because that is all what I could do. My time, my talent, and my treasure. When that happens, voila. I think America can actually really lead a humongous revival in the world at all levels, whether it be economic or spiritual or cultural. I think you've gone through the mill. You've learned how to live with diversity more than most. We're still struggling with xenophobia in Africa. We're still fighting with each other's tribes. But you've got New York. For goodness sake, you've got San Francisco. You've got Berkeley. You've learned how to do it. What is it that you have that God can use? At least you have me. You can pray that God should use me. We work in southern Zambia. We deliver wheelchairs to rural areas. We get young people in the deep, deep rural areas with club feet. And you know all what it takes? It's 300 euros. I don't know what that is in US dollars. To get those kids' legs straightened out. And I tell you now, when you get into that village, they think we are lieutenants of Jesus Christ. I mean, they won't even let us walk on the ground. We have to convince them that we're human beings. That, hey, by the way, we are hungry too. Can you give us something to eat? Because they cannot imagine that we've got any need. Just a man, 35 years, walking with his hands because he had polio. We give him a wheelchair. He fenced 2 hectares. Now, 2 hectares is about 5 acres where we're planting sweet potatoes. He got onto that wheelchair. His shoulders are 10 times the size of his waist because all his life, that's all what he's been doing, developing those shoulders. And he dug all the holes for all the poles of the place where we're planting virus-free sweet potatoes. And 2 weeks ago, we were there. And we're doing juice. You can do juice out of sweet potato. Not just punk, not potato pie. You can do juice. You can do fritters. You can do jam. We've learned to do all these things. In Zimbabwe, noch all. That's where the technology has been developed. Out there. And you say to me, Caesar, are you a millionaire? I said, not even near being one. But decided we're going to do something. So instead of buying a Mercedes-Benz, I bought a truck, drive a 4x4. It's all what I could do. I mean, it's stupid, believe me, to drive a huge truck like that in Johannesburg. But when I'm out there in the sticks, it's a wonderful thing to have. What is it that you've got that God can use? That you can use in God's name for His glory. Think about it. then you find yourself that actually, you know, I don't have to be Warren Buffett to be a philanthropist. I can have my own sense of being one by giving what I've got. God bless.
Thank you, Caesar. We invite you to come back across to the sanctuary for our closing worship service that'll start at 5:30.